Oh, yes, my friends. It's the Show and Sleeve Show.
Take my hat, take my coat, take my gloves, I'll take a cup. Take my money, but I'm begging, please don't take my shoe. Take my house, take my clothes, take my wife, lighten up my load. Take my feet, you can take my toes, but please don't take my shoe.
From the downtowniest part of New York City, the city that never sleeps, the city that never weeps, the city where nothing keeps. Coming to you live on WCJD 90.2, New York, high atop the Empire State Building.
And good evening, my friends. This is Show and Sleeves, and you are listening to the Radio Ghost. You're listening to it live. I put that in double quotes. This evening's show, or how to put it, it was partially recorded. So it's a bit of a goblin show. The part that I'm recording right now at this moment actually did not play during the live show, because this part of the program did not tape. I call it tape. I like that word better than record. I like the idea of tape being missing rather than digital information not being stored. So the tape was not spinning, for reasons unknown, and I'm attempting to remake a few sections, the beginning, the middle part, a tiny section at the end, pieces that didn't record. Now, I'm saying that this is a partially differently dressed Radio Ghost number 39. Somewhat the same, somewhat different. I'm going to do the best that I can using the old tin can bean bag of a memory that I've got to piecemeal it all together. So shortly before the show, I was outside walking around on some forgettable mission. It's all life itself. That could be the slogan. Life, the forgettable mission. That's not to say we shouldn't honor it or consider it beautiful or holy or sacred. It's only that the chores and the things that we get to are not important. Our missions, which we have no choice but to accept, but they don't need historical recording. You don't need to be observed by cameras. You don't need to have all that written down. Then he went to the barn. His hand came upon the door, and he stood for a moment, bored out of his mind. Now, I don't know. I'm sure there are times in my life where I am bored out of my mind. That was more of a fictionalized version. I don't feel bored anymore, though I think most of what I do might be considered boring. If you did watch me, I think you'd always be falling asleep. But anyway, before the show, I was in this colorless adventure, moving about my meadows and things, and I saw a white ferret, or mink, or weasel, all completely white, like the stripe, the skunk stripe. In fact, I thought it was a skunk stripe. So the dark parts of the skunk, skunks can tend to be round, roundish, almost porcupine-like, very belly-based. But this seemed to be as though the center white-striped part of the skunk had separated from the main belly part of the skunk and shot away. So the skunk had shot its white stripe off, and I watched this, and because I've never seen an all-white animal like this in this area. It looked like an Arctic hare. If an Arctic hare was long and broom handle-like. So I watched this little white mink, which really should... They're so long. They're so long, and it's like they should have a pair of legs in the middle of their body to support that distance. They're Cadillac bodies that need a third set of wheels right in the middle to support them, but they don't, so they get the inchworm look, the hunched back. So this ferret weasel mink goes hopping along over the logs, and I'm watching it, wondering. Now, aside from wondering what it was, is it a skunk, centerpiece? Is it a weasel, ferret mink? Because I don't know. I'm sure it's one of those things, probably not a mink, probably not a ferret. It's probably not even a weasel, some other elongated rodent. One of the long rodents. But the first thing I think, the first practical thought that I have is, I wonder how much I could get for that pelt. So it's like I'm a trapper. Now why should it be? Why should it be that I, who have never trapped, I am not a trapper. I have not been a mountain man who goes out in the mornings and checks his trap lines and then takes his creatures back home and does all that business, getting the skin off, hanging them from the trees that they dry, coating them in snake oil. I've never sold a single pelt, and yet the first thought that I have is, how much could I get for that pelt? And inside me there is the spirit of the trapper. Very mysterious creatures we are. We seem to be clinically unable to remember who we are from time to time, given different experiences.
Here is another good time for the music! Dun, dun, dun!
Telephone. 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 Telephone.
cut smoke is up to me, my love, my love, my love. I was born on a rowboat, floating so low, down the river, down the alone. Sun so hot, the moon so cold, the earth so young, the world so old. I don't feel it, I don't feel my soul. I bought a green car, I bought a cargo, I bought a fast bar, I bought a fast boat, I bought an island, bought an ocean, I bought a kiss and some sun lotion.
I go, my dear, I take you feel right. I go, my dear, I've got you on the line. Set me on the ground, don't let me in. Hang it up, my dear, and let it ring. The telephone, your telephone, telephone.
I have a history with shovels. I don't know exactly when this began, but I was a boy, between 5 and 7, perhaps older. It must have followed some reading of a treasure story, because that's what I was after. I remember going out to my father's shed, and I thought of it as his shed. His tiny little box in the backyard. It wasn't a place that my mother ever went. It wasn't a place that I was myself allowed to go. There were dangerous things in there, sharp things, mechanical things. I think my father kept some sort of glassed bottle of spirits. It would some days be the rising whiff of smoke. There was a small window in the shed as well that I would sometimes see him peering out of. So he went there and did what most people do in sheds. They potter around, and then it was the container of his freedom in some way. It's where he wasn't my father, he wasn't anyone. He was whatever he liked. He would drink whatever it was and smoke whatever it was and look out the window and be among the sharp things and the mechanical objects. At any rate, it was his shed, and I knew I wasn't supposed to go in there. My mother didn't want to go in there, but after the reading of Treasure Island or something with buried treasure, I became fascinated and increasingly curious about digging holes and unearthing what would be both easy and clearly readily available. Treasure chests of all kinds. Large and small, some perhaps not as filled as others, but regardless, with gold and rubies and emeralds and, in point of fact, I didn't know what would be within a treasure chest. It was a kind of a glowing bounty, a glowing, shining, almost like the sun itself inside the treasure chest. Not that I had any idea what I would do with that treasure. The treasure itself was the end. To possess it was the point. which is a great difference between being a child and being an adult. When you're pursuing treasure as a child, you're pursuing the glowing golden sun of it. You don't have an intention, any other intention but that to behold it. In fact, beholding it precedes possession of it. You simply wish to see it. And I was the sort of boy that seeing it would be enough. Unearthing it, discovering it, opening it at a distance is somehow in my mind. It was never my hands unlatching the treasure chest and pushing it open. I was always some 20 yards off. And it magically would open and the golden light would pour out. And I would sigh. Eternally, that sigh would last. Forever. Now, it may be that, I mean, as I think about it now, if I unearthed a treasure chest and I beholded the golden sunny innards, I don't know that I would do anything else with it. I'd bring it inside, perhaps. I'd put it in a nice spot. Comfortable spot. Or I could behold it whenever I liked, but I don't think I would turn it into dollar bills or put it in the bank or sell it to anyone. I might not even allow it to become a museum curiosity, as I think a lot of generous-hearted persons might. We'd think of the world and present it to the world for its safekeeping. But so as a boy of 5 or 6, as this treasure chest fantasy reached a kind of fever pitch, I found myself finally making my way out to my father's shed. Now, there was no lock on the door. No, it was just a piece of wood that swung across it to keep it shut. And yet, turning that piece of wood felt like the greatest type of intrusion, as though I had secretly stolen the key off some ring that he kept on his belt while he slept, and now I was breaking in to his very private shed. Now, at the time, I had no curiosity about the smoke or the glass bottle, any of it. Later I did, but not then. At the time, that's what I thought these sheds were. That's all fathers went off to these sheds. They created smoke, and they came back smelling. I didn't know what it was, but power. It was like a petrol, a fuel. Not that my father was some street drunk. He would only do this once a week, and only for a little while. He'd just go out and have a little sip and then come back. And I don't think he was even interested in the drinking or the smoking so much as to, just to be independent. Regardless, so I go into the shed, grab a shovel. I'll tell you this, since that came out. It was a joke between my parents, and it lasted well into my teens, the embarrassing later years, to remind me that I used to call shovels, shovels. Now, I can only say that that's why it crept back into my mouth. My old baby terminology back into my mouth. So I would go into the shed and grab what I called in, and now, hopefully for the last time, a shovel. And I walked back into our very small yard and began to dig. I used no intuitive logic about the place where I was digging. I simply took a few steps from the shed and just struck the shovel down. Because my expectation was that treasures existed where you dug for them. This was despite the fact that whatever the book I had read, Treasure Island, involved maps, of course. There would be a map and you'd have to go see the trees that look like the snake fangs, and then from there you would go to the Mount of the Lion. And then beside the figure of the moon you could dig at the X that marked the spot. That did not matter to me. I got it into my head, and I think it's common that treasure was where you dug for it. So I began to dig. Now, children can't dig for long. You two shovelfuls are not even that. 2 inches down, and already I was anxious for my treasure. There was also this mediating quality that the mind has. So, even as I began to dig, perhaps I knew that I wasn't going to discover. Perhaps there's some older part of ourselves that's always there that's... we sometimes can hear, sometimes not, but that guides us. Perhaps as I began to dig, that older self said, there's nothing. You won't be able to find anything down there. So, you can keep digging if you like. I'm just saying. And that older self then conveys you along so that you're not so disappointed. They keep your hope up while letting you know that you don't have to dig and dig and dig and dig. And so after a few minutes, I simply gave up. I left the shovel where it was. Of course, thinking of it as a shovel, besides a small pile of dirt, it almost looked like an unenthusiastic attempt. So I couldn't have been that serious, and yet I was. I was deeply serious. But something had come into my mind, along with this adult, perhaps, if it was there, I'm imagining it, but I think it's there. And I simply wandered off into the woods, which was something that I did a lot of the time. If I was confused, I would wander off into the woods. If I was dreamy or thoughtful, I would go off into the woods. If I had responsibilities that I didn't want to face, off in the woods. So I began digging, and then all of a sudden I found myself walking off into the woods. Now this digging for treasure continued and became a more enthusiastic, or found a more enthusiastic expression. I dug deeper holes as I got older, and then I began making myself treasure maps. And then I began burying treasures for myself to find. I would bury a treasure, make a map, and then a week or so later, I would go and dig it up. And then even further on down the line, this all became this other strange bit of behavior. I would go off into the woods with my shovel. This doesn't even seem the same anymore to what won't. It will seem like a bit of gardening. But I connect it up to the treasure chest seeking. I would go into the woods and I would transplant small trees in bushes and whatever I could find. I would dig things up and plant them nearby but elsewhere. A small pine tree, I would dig it up and I would move it perhaps 5 or 6 feet and set it down again. Now at first this was just, I don't know why I started this, I think it was that there was a path that went through the forest, which I may have myself made, and it wasn't a dramatic path for all the world to walk. It was an almost animal-like path, and I think there was a tree that was bothering me, was leaning into my path, and I wanted to move it, so I did. And I liked the experience, because the tree survived my transplanting of it. I became curious of moving other trees until there was a small patch that I became the moderator of. This section of the forest of switched up trees and plants and some flowers, little strange forest flowers, tiny, white, and some little partridge berries, winter berries, red, very bright red berries that children and babies want to eat. But of course, I was told instantly lethal, and to this day I believe that and also don't, but now I say this because just the other day I went out to my own shed where I keep no spirits, nothing to smoke, and I grabbed a shovel, and it was one of those lackluster overcast days where everything's unsure or something. Removed from possibility. Many people can simply carry on through with their day, but I woke up and I knew at once it was one of those silver and bothered days where nothing really could be done except make it to lunch, make it to supper, and then bed, and hopefully will be corrected by tomorrow. So I was a lot of little wandering around. I couldn't even go for a good, solid, long walk. I was too distracted. But I found my shovel. I grabbed it, a long-handled shovel, almost as tall as myself, something that was here when I took ownership, some old farmer's shovel, and I just stood out in the field for a few moments, and then I started digging. Just put it down, very casual, thoughtless digging. And I was done almost immediately. It wasn't some sweaty affair. But I looked down and I saw a very small pile of dirt beside a very undramatically attempted hole, and it completely reminded me of all the treasure digging that I'd done. In fact, as I looked down on it, I thought, that's my first hole. There was something about the tininess of the hole and the smallness of the dirt that was completely remembered to me, the image of it. Even though I was much taller and seeing it from a different height, I bent down and it came into this kind of thrilling, epiphanous focus that somehow my body, as a 5 or 6 year old, and now my body the other day, had a way of digging that would result in this exact type of replica when I wasn't thinking about it. And I'd almost completely forgotten all this earlier digging. Until then. Till that moment where I stood with my small hole digging for treasure with some old farmer's shovel.
Could lead me further, someone would
Just now realize that I'm wearing slippers, bedroom slippers. Well, not bedroom slippers. I suppose they call them bedroom slippers, but you don't march from the bed to the bedroom door and remove them and put on your hall slippers. Walk down the hall and put on your bathroom slippers. Go into the living room with your living room slippers. Out on the porch. Oh, my porch slippers. So I'm in my all-in-ones. My all-in-one slippers. I suppose they're forest slippers now, too. They're sturdy, though. They always deceive me with their sturdiness. You put them on to move comfortably about. In the very undangerous landscape of the hall, the kitchen. Very soft on the sides. I suppose shoes are hard because we don't want boulders falling on our feet and crushing them. And sticks poking through. And drop a knife. I must drop a knife a week, a sharp one, too. Just right off the counter, lands right next to my foot. And I often have that sensation of knowing I've dropped the knife, but I can't move the foot. It's too late. So I have to wait that very long half second for the knife to hit the floor. And during that time, I'm wishing and thinking all these thoughts about Well, hopefully that old knife won't go right into my foot. I certainly hope it doesn't. But then I can also imagine it. I can see it going right in, sharp side down, right through my soft all-in-one slippers. I can picture the blood. Huge stories, volumes of dreams suddenly unfold. A whole universe of thoughts. And then a week passes, it happens again. I never can get my foot away. But the knife never hits my foot. What are the odds of that inaccuracy? I'm a little disappointed I haven't at least had the flat side of the knife come down and bounce off the top of my foot. Or even the sharp knife, I wouldn't mind if it went down between my toes. I certainly don't want to be injured, but something seems off. The odds aren't right. I think there's a term for it. There's paintings that you see. Usually they have an element of kitsch to them, where the eyes follow you. What is that trick called? It's not trompe l'oeil, which is... But I think there's a term for it. Maybe there's not. Where the artist somehow renders the painted eye in such a way that no matter where you stand observing it, the eyes seem to be watching you. The haunted house paintings. Although I think some of the old masters can put those eyes in. Mona Lisa, she may have those trick eyes. All Leonardo's contemporaries were like, but it's very nice, Leonardo, but why did you do the spook house eyes? So I'm talking about that, but what I mean to say is that today, the sun, our very own great star in the sky, no matter where you stand, it burns a hole right in your head. Completely eye-killing. Now, what is that? There are days when you cannot get your face away from the sun. You're always staring at it, no matter how you turn about. It's throwing its golden spears into your retinas. You're always squinting and staring down and blocking it out. Maybe perhaps it's a Leonardo sun. It's a spook house sun. Leonardo's spook house sun. My all-in-one slippers. Leonardo's spook house sun. Occasionally I'll come up with odd phrases like that strike me. I want to write a story about that. The all-in-one slippers and Leonardo's. I can't even remember it. I heard of a country and western singer. I want to say his name is Hal Ketchum, but that's not it. But he never wrote down the lyrics of his songs. I think I've mentioned this in an earlier Radio Ghost, but I'm just reminded of it. He never wrote them down. And his opinion was, if he couldn't remember them, they weren't worth remembering in the first place. So all his songs had to have that quality of unforgettability, the lyrics at least. That's very strong. It's a very strong position. And far too brave. I hear this noise. It sounds like a bus. A sky bus. Not an aptly named airplane that ferries people from one place to another, but it sounds like an actual bus in the sky. So I saw a moose last week, standing in a very small pond, up to his hips, his fore hips. That's what meese like to do. They like to fetch themselves into a nice pond and stand there stock still. I don't know what they do. I don't know if they're looking for fish or they just like to stand there. It's a preference that they have. They certainly don't seem to benefit from it. I don't think there's anything there that they're eating. They don't dip those long wooden snouts into the brown muck and pull out frogs or fish and have lunch. They simply stand there like they're waiting to be painted. When you come upon a moose, he's always seen you first. And one thing you will wonder about meese, if you come upon them, is, are they always that still? They're very hard to see as well from there for that stillness. You have to look exactly where they are and almost have in your mind, look for the moose. Be looking for the moose, otherwise you'll pass right over them. Their stillness blends them away, their brown, dull stillness. They just look like murk. Rough, brown paint spillage on the air. And not many people know this about the moose. They're a very varied creature. They can be vicious. They're a terrible meese in the world. Just awful meese. Some of the worst creatures. Sharks can be terrible and bite your leg off and things. But meese, there are meese that will go out of their way just to step on your foot. Especially if you're wearing slippers. There's some just very cruel meese. Turkeys as well have a lot of cruel fellows in their brood. So meese, if you come upon one, you have to be careful, even these stock still ones in the pond. Because they may just climb on out and start walking toward you. That wooden look on their face. That's another thing. To me, the moose is the most tree-like of the animals. So if ever there was a tree decided it wanted to turn into any animal, it'd have to turn into a moose. Or, I suppose in my imagination, as I perceive evolution, I can see the moose going back through time and starting off life as an oak. So millions of years ago, there's an oak tree. And then the oak tree wants to stand in a pond, and it evolves toward that in the form of a moose. So I've mentioned the terrible moose, then I should mention the wonderful moose, the enlightened moose, the wise meese. The wise meese of the Kubla Plains. Now we have these wise meese here. It's very difficult to know if you've got a wise moose on your hands. But I've met one. And it's difficult to describe the experience of this And I'm finding it difficult to tell the story because it doesn't seem to make sense. But these wise meese, there are not many of them. Far more of the cruel footstepping ones. These wise meese, aside from the guttural noises that all meese make, and that they also make this absurd high-pitched noise that sounds like a mouse, with the megaphone. These wise mice somehow have learned to say a single word, and that word is lump. So, if you are a moose fancier, if you are a follower of the mice, both revolted by and attracted to the kingdom of the mice, you will eventually hear about this word. Some people call them lump mice, the lump mice. Essentially, let me describe this. So, and I go to this pond, and I see this moose standing in the pond. I stare at him for a while, he stares at me. And then I say, lump, just to see if he'll say lump back. Now, generally it works the other way. You come upon one of these wise mice in the forest somewhere else. They will say the word to you, lump. That's it, staring at you. They'll say it, lump. And then, it's almost instinct. There isn't anyone, even a person who's never been in the forest before, who doesn't even know what a moose is, will themselves automatically say, lump, back. So there's this brief conversation, lump, lump. And after you say it, in your shock, the moose will then say lump again. And that can go on. And I'm quite certain every day in the forest here in New Hampshire there are two or three conversations of whatever length between moose and person. Lump, 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 like tennis. Now, it may seem unremarkable, it may seem unclear, what is this about, where are we getting, but if you have ever experienced this, not many people have, you will deeply feel that some threshold has been crossed, some communication between the species has just occurred. Now, you can't go back to your human being camp and say, I have word from the mice. And nor can the moose go back and tell all the other mice what some sort of information that we've handed off. We can't communicate in that way of mutual understanding, but only in this way of, it's almost affection. It's a peaceful affection in the forest. Lump, 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 lump. When I did it, went on for 10 minutes, perhaps. And it's not that fast. It's much slower. I sped it up. The moose would say lump, and then you say it. And then it tends to slow down. The moose becomes especially slow. It can be a minute or two before he will respond. And then, as a sign of respect, you don't want to immediately, right after he says lump, say lump back, so you wait about the same time. That in itself is a part of this affectionate communication. Another thing about the moose, there are some, different than the cruel mice, different than the wise mice, there are what I think of as the soldiers, the soldier mice. Now, these are mice that will go through the forest looking to do battle with whatever they find. Not because they're cruel, but because they enjoy warfare. So an army, there are these armies of single soldier mice going through the woods, and they especially like to do battle with deer. Now, there's only one way to know whether you've got one of these army mice. It's simple, but it can be difficult to detect. They will always have a small stick in their mouth. like a cheroot sticking out, very small stick. And when they see the enemy deer, this stick will move to the front position of their teeth, and they will aim it toward the deer as though their intent is to spear it like a bayonet. Now, the deer themselves are mostly helpless and useless and strange and skittish and go off, but there are some deer that organize themselves into small armies of 6 deer teams. Doesn't matter the mix, some boys, some girls. And their whole purpose is to convince the moose, these soldier meese, one by one, to stop doing the soldiering. And for whatever reason, they figured out this method of doing this. So this 6-team army of deer, when they see a moose, a soldier moose with a stick, they will all at once begin limping around. Limping around the woods. This is to attract the moose's fierceness. Now, the moose will look at all 6 of these deers and find the limpiest one, the most limpingest, the limpid. And he will aim toward that one. The little stick will come forward and he'll charge. Now, you'd think, what can the deer do now? He's limping around pretending to be injured, and now there's a moose with a stick charging toward him. What can he do? Well, these smart army deer do the strangest thing that there can be. They create the strangest scene in the forest that can ever be seen, even more strange than the lump conversation. Like flamingos, they will bring 3 of their legs up, shift their 4th leg to the center point of their body, and stand like flamingos on 1 leg, which for some reason absolutely terrifies the moose, who either cannot make up the connection between the movements that the deer is unfolding and suddenly thinks it's attacking some bizarre one-legged creature, or because he's never seen this before does not understand that he's even running at a deer anymore. The deer has disappeared, and in its place this sculpture of fur. So the moose will swerve off and attack next the most limpingest deer left. That one will do the same. The tri-legs will come up, the 1 leg will pod down. All throughout this. Now, whether this absolutely convinces the soldier moose that he must stop his warring ways, I don't know. I don't know how you could find that out unless you followed. But I do believe that this is the deer's way of attempting to stop these warmongers from their mongering. Perhaps render them somehow back into regular, cruel meese. So such a moose with the stick would drop the stick and come to his senses and say, well, you know, I'm just be a cruel moose and step on feet. Or perhaps I will learn how to say the lump word.
Well, now 500,000 miles from my candle, how the moon doth wane. Oh, up above the trees and the meeses and the bald stiff rain. Well, now hands up. Rubber neck, here come a moose got a world wreck. Look how they're all limp. Pacification of the moose, one-legged gun.
What a pretty picture if they fell to the floor and it busted up his hatch and his crown forevermore. What a pretty picture if they fell to the floor and it busted up his hatch and his crown forevermore. What a pretty picture if they fell to the floor and it busted up his hatch and his crown forevermore.
Pretty picture he fell to the floor and he busted up his hatch and his crown. Now, some people might think it's perverse to sing along to your own song like that. Now, maybe if someone else wrote it, it's all right to sing along. But if you wrote the song yourself and you're singing along in the background, that's not right. But it's an automatic thing. Because I had to sing along with it originally. When it comes up, I have to do it again. It's more like there's a feeling of mowing the lawn or raking the leaves. It's a bit of work that I'm doing there. It comes out automatically. So, my friends, we have come to the end of another Radio Ghost episode, episode number 39. The rebooted Radio Ghost, basically the same boot. Nothing different at all, I just put it out in front of you again. We will be back here for the foreseeable future of Wednesdays. 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Wednesday nights, simultaneously in Australia at noon, beginning at noon, in whatever they call it there. They call it Eastern Standard Time here. Perhaps they call it Middle of the Ocean Time there. And Thursday. We do both days, Wednesday and Thursday, simultaneously. It's a two-day project. We managed to penetrate using our little space needle, go right from Wednesday directly into Thursday. But I do thank you for joining me. I'm grateful for your companionship. I look forward to speaking to you again next week. But it is, my friends, tired, and I am, my friends, late. So until next time, always merry and bright. It's tired, and I'm late. The old frozen fire turn out late. Tomorrow we'll slip through town, side every turn up, thing down. But now it's time to sweep. It's tired and I'm late. Untie your candles, I just lit the skates. We're sitting in sleepless light, come dreams to a sleeping right. But now it's time to swim.
Hit a ball now.
It's tired and I'm late. Your frozen fire turn out late. Tomorrow we'll sleep through town, side every turn up, thing down. But now it's time to sweep.